So this is the second of the Soyinka podcasts. Where we left off with the first one was the setup where Amusa is ready to go to talk to try to get Elation to stop, right? He walks into the marketplace in the middle of Elation basically having sex in one of the stalls, and the women of the marketplace stop him, right? And this shows you kind of where Amusa is basically in the kind of power pecking order there, insofar as that the women don't even deal with him or the other police officers there. They basically send out their daughters to make fun of them. And the way the daughters make fun of Amusa, the way they basically scare off Amusa and the other police officers, is by imitating British women, right? We've seen this before. We saw it with Douglas in this notion of mimicry, this idea that you know, the people with power want the powerless to act like them, but they can never be sure that the intents of those who are powerless are what the people who have power really want from them. So the daughters of the marketplace basically make fun of Amusa by telling the truth of the way the British act towards all Nigerians, let alone those that they are able to compromise and co-opt the way they've done with Amusa. So they basically chase Amusa off and send him scurrying away, and we end up with Elation having finished basically taking care of himself, doing what he wanted. Now he's finally willing to do what he needs to do for the good of the tribe. And we basically end that scene with him putting himself in this trance, dancing himself into this trance that is going to end up with his death. We're not supposed to really ask about this. This is foreign to Westerners, but to those who would practice an animistic or tribal religion, this makes sense, right? The power that he's willing to exert and able to exert over his own body. But this is not going to happen, because when we get to scene four, and Amusa has basically said, listen, I was unable to do what you asked me to do. Simon is willing to take an entire group of people out and address this on his own, even though he's in the middle of this, this masked ball, right? We see that Simon's getting some pressure here too from his boss, basically, and his boss's boss, and the fact that the prince is there. And we get this really unexpected visitor, right? We'd call this, if this were a 18th century play, we'd call this the third act discovery. But here in the fourth act, what we get is this new character who's going to be really important, Olunde. Now, Olunde is Elation's son, who's been away at medical school in London for years. Right? It turns out the Pilkings wanted him to go because he was smart. Elation didn't want him to go, and this causes a great rift between the Pilkings and Elation. But they figure they're doing the right thing. They're taking a smart kid and they're training him up. Kind of, maybe it's Soyinka's commentary on his own life. And of course, we see that we get Olunde engaged in his conversation with Jane, Simon's wife, and this becomes really, like, if you want to kind of get the crystalline moment of what's going on in this play, the idea that this conversation, this argument between Jane and Olunde is really crucial, right? She says, when Simon has already gone on, and Olunde is looking for him to try to convince Simon not to do this. Don't go after my husband. Don't go after my father. Let him do what he's got to do. He's got to do this, right? But this is not what's going to happen, right? So here's Olunde and Jane happening right here at the beginning of scene four, right? And Jane recognizes him, and they get into this conversation. We're going to get this kind of this cosmic image through this little story that Jane tells. She says, It's a little hot, I gotta confess, Jane says, but it's all in a good wearing these masks, she means. But it's all in a good cause, and what causes that? You know, the ball and His Highness being here. And Olunde asks, so that's why you're desecrating this mask? Oh, Jane says, oh, you're shocked after all. And Olunde says, no, I'm not shocked. I've spent 4 years among your people. I discovered that you have no respect for what you do not understand. And this is one of the primary points. You have no respect for what you do not understand. Lots of people attempted to read this when it first came out as a clash of cultures text. Just two cultures that bashed against one another and they had kind of competing ideas. And Soyeka says, no, you cannot read this as that because in order for two cultures to clash, they have to at least understand one another. They have to at least attempt. But the British, he says, never attempted that. Oh, and Jane says, so you got a chip on your shoulder. I guess you didn't like your stay in England. And Linda says, no, your people were admirable. I admired their conduct and courage in this war, right? We see this World War II. And Jane says, oh, yeah, but it's pretty remote, right? And here I am, right? Convoy comes through every once in a while, but that ship that was blown up in the harbor, that was pretty interesting. And Olunde says, well, you mean through enemy action? And Jane says, no, the war isn't that close, but the captain did it himself. I don't quite understand it. Simon tried to explain the ship had to be blown up because it had become dangerous to other ships, even to the city. Hundreds of the coastal population would have died. And Olunde says, trying to understand, or maybe it's loaded with ammunition, caught fire, they had to use lethal gases. Jane says, something like that, but the captain blew himself up with it deliberately. Someone had to remain on board to light the fuse. And Olunde, in one of the very rare jokes in this thing, says, must have been a really short fuse. A decent joke, works much better on stage than it does on the page, right? Jane says, I don't know much about it, only there's no other way to save lives, no time to devise anything. And Olunde says, yeah, I met people like that, I believe that, right? And Jane says, oh, here I am telling you this morbid news. And Olunde says, it's not morbid at all, it's affirmative. The captain's self-sacrifice is a good thing. And Jane says, nonsense. Life should never deliberately be thrown away. And the innocent people around the harbor, oh, how does one know? And there, in that little interchange there, right, we get this idea, this captain who literally gives his life for the good of others. Wow, sounds kind of like Alation or what Alation was supposed to be doing. In actuality, right, and here's the way Olunde sees it. This is a noble thing to do. If you're going to die anyway, why not give your life in service to others? And Jane says, and rightly so, you know, life should never deliberately be thrown away. And so we've got these two opposing things that are both correct. Self-sacrifice and life should never deliberately be thrown away. Let's reason together and argue this out and find the best things. That would be a clash of cultures. But instead, what Jane says is, the whole thing was probably exaggerated anyway. She gives it up, right? She cannot engage with understanding another culture, understanding another point of view that might make sense as well as hers. And Olunde says, well, that can't happen, right? Well, Jane's trying to explain that, you know, there's this little problem in town. Simon had to go take away from it, right? Had to go deal with it. You must know what my husband is trying to do for you. And Olunde says, for me, for you, for your people. Right? And she asks, how did you get here? And he says, well, I got a cable saying the king was dead. So I knew I had to come here because I knew I had to bury my father. Well, how did you know that? Well, because, and this you'd think in 4 or 5 years of being there, they'd understand this already. Well, because when the king dies, then the king's horseman has to die 30 days later. So I knew I had to get back here and bury him. So I ended up getting on the same convoy with the prince, right? And the same number of ships. Right, same group of ships, which at the time is a very brave thing to do. We're talking World War II in the North Atlantic, right? 60% of convoys from the United Kingdom were attacked in the North Atlantic by German U-boats traveling in wolf packs. It was one of the most effective devices that the Germans, that the Axis powers had in the war. And yet here's HRH, here's His Royal Highness, willing to take that trip, right? Right, I came home to bury my father, says Olunde. Right, but don't you think your father's entitled to whatever protection he gets? And Olunde says, listen, he has protection. He has protection greater than anything you could offer him. Right? What can you offer him in place of peace of mind, in place of honor and veneration of his own people? What would you think of your prince if he hadn't come here, right? If he was too afraid? Jane says, oh, well, I see you've studied argumentation in England. You learned how to put up a fight, right? And Alunda says, yet another error into which your people fall. You believe that everything which appears to make sense was learned from you. And Jane says, you know, and Jane's going to make a decent point here, right? You've learned to argue, I can tell that, but I never said you made sense. However cleverly you try to put it, this is still a barbaric custom. Even worse, it's feudal. The king dies and the chieftain must be buried. How feudalistic can you get? And Alunde, in a response that truly isn't sufficient to this question that Jane asks, I think he says, and this, even in the midst of the devastating war, what would you call this? Well, we call it therapy British style, the preservation of sanity. And he Alunde says others would call it decadence. I just don't think it works that well, right? But then he gives this great little argument here. By all logical and natural laws, this war should end with all the white races wiping out one another, wiping out their so-called civilization for all time and reverting to a state of primitivism, the like of which has so far only existed in your imagination when you thought of us. I thought all that at the beginning, then slowly I realized that your greatest art is the art of survival. But at least have the humility to let others survive in their own way. And Jane says, through ritual suicide? And Alunde says, is that worse than mass suicide? Right? What do you call what those young men are sent to do? Okay. And then he talks about, they get into an argument about the nature of truth, and right, we call it strategic victories, even though it's a loss, right? We never suggest that anything's the opposite of the way it is, right? And Jane says, well, listen, you came back and you still got this beef, right? Was it about race? Was it about color? I know there's some discrimination. And Alunde says, it's not that simple. You make it sound as when I left, I took nothing with me. Right? Yes, and to tell you the truth, only this evening, Simon and I said we never really knew what you left with. Right? Neither did I, and I'm grateful to your country for showing me what I did leave with, and I'll never give it up. Right? And Jane says, don't throw away what you started to do. You wanted to be a doctor. My husband and I believe you'll make an excellent one. Alunde says, of course not. I'm not going to throw this away. Right? I intend to return and complete my training once the burial of my father is over. Listen, come outside, right? They're going to go outside. And it's the drums, right? He tells them to listen to the drums, right? Mrs. Pilkings, are you all right? She'll be all right. And who are you? Who the hell asked your opinion? Right? The aide-de-camp says, Alunde says, I got to go. I got business to attend to. But it turns out the business is coming to him. Right? I can't stay long. Because how does Act 4 end, Scene 4 end? With, oh, it looks like Simon was successful, and he has stopped Elation from the ritual suicide, which means he's missed his opportunity to go join the king and be his horseman, be his guide into the next life, right? So he's going to lock him up. And this the fifth scene here that's coming up is really kind of the placement of it is important. We realize that it is put in the, well, before we get there, let's look at just the last line there, right? Elation is led in chains, and he looks and he sees the sun and says, Alunde, don't let the sight of your father turn you blind. And Alunde says, I have no father. Eater of leftovers, the worst insult he can give a father. Eater of leftovers. Eater of food that another man has provided, right? You are not a father. You are not a provider. You are not a decent chief. A chief's job is to provide for the wants and needs of his people. You force them to eat leftovers. And boom, we go to scene five, right? Scene five. Now notice we move back and forth and back and forth. Marketplace, administrative building, marketplace, administrative building. Scene five is actually the basement or the cellar of that administrative building, which is used as a storage facility now, but it literally was originally built to house slaves, right? So the very foundations of the colonial administration, I think the symbolic import here is crucial. The very foundations of the colonial project is based on slavery, right? And look, Elation is chained up, manacled. His hands are chained together inside one of the cells. And this is how this whole scene takes place. Elation has failed. Pilking still doesn't understand that what he's done was wrong. Elation still doesn't understand that had he done what he was supposed to do, before he started worrying about what clothes he was wearing and what sex he was going to have, Simon would have never been able to stop him. And Eliashib, of course, because he's a great speaker, is trying to blame it all on the white man, trying to blame it all on the colonizer. And Pilkings gives up a decent defense, and it seems to be going pretty well until, well, Jane comes in for a little bit, and that's not that big a deal. But I'm telling you what, when Eliashib comes in, then Eliashib meets someone who is his equal and who actually knows his culture. And boy, she just starts laying into him, right? Everything that he has deserved since scene one, and probably well before scene one, his whole life, basically, she starts laying it out to him. Simon sees an opportunity to kind of jump in and justify himself. He wants to get in on it too. And Eliashib having none of that, right? It's like, yeah, I get to beat up my little brother, but don't let anybody else touch him, right? Eliashib says, I gave you good warning. You have failed and everything. And Eliashib's trying to explain it to himself, right? No. But Eliashib says, I am not having none of that, right? But Pilkings tries to jump in. Oh, let's see what it is. I got to jump in. What's she saying now? Christ, must your people speak forever in riddles? And we don't make our chiefs commit suicide to keep them company. And Eliashib, right, in this great little insult, child, right? You have small and little understanding. I have not come here to help your understanding. This is the man whose weakened understanding holds us in bondage to you. But ask him if you wish. He knows the meaning of the king's passage. He'll give you the explanation. He'll tell you why he's failed, if he's man enough to admit it, if he's honest enough to admit that he is a failure. And while this is going on, right, a group of people come in with a carpet rolled up on their shoulders. And you're thinking that this carpet is, you know, it's just carpet. It's a storage facility and things like that. Now, I've only seen this play twice, and both times I've seen it down in the thrust stage, which means that the stage goes out into the audience, and the audience is around three sides of the stage. And that's really kind of crucial for the staging here, because you get this great, shocking reveal here that's happening, right, kind of at the tail end of this. After we've gone through all this, right, they've slain the favorite horse of the king. Even the praise singer starts getting into that. There's this dirge, rises and fails. There lies the swiftest messenger of the king. We placed the reins of the world in your hands, and you took us over the edge. Right? Because look who's there. As that dirge rises and falls, I cannot approach, right? I shall speak my message to the heart, right? And as they unroll out the mat, who's in the center of the mat? Right, as he gets rolled like right into the middle of the audience, it's the dead body of Olunde. Olunde, knowing his father has failed, has taken his father's place as the king's horseman and killed himself, ritually sacrificing himself for the good of the tribe. Wow, powerful, the son taking the place of the father. Just kind of overwhelming. But what solidifies Eliashib as a terrible, selfish man is what he does next. Eliashib then takes one arm and wraps the manacle around his neck and strangles himself with the manacles. Right? Pulls the loop of the chain, strangles himself, as it says, with a swift and decisive pull. Why does he do that? It does no good for the tribe. The tribe already has a king's horseman. It's been his son. He does it because he can't face his own shame. Because of one last selfish act. Yes, he may be full of grief. He may be full of despair. He may have realized this. But his death does nothing for anybody except himself. It puts him out of his misery. But he's already left the tribe in a precarious position. Olunde has assumed his position in order to try to help the tribe. And the only thing that's left, and it's incredibly tenuous, is what Eliashib does at the very end when she turns to that woman, the bride that Eliashib slept with way back in scene 3, and says, you, don't think about the present, don't think about the dead, forget even the living. Turn your mind only to the unborn. That's the last bit of hope the tribe has. Turn your mind to the unborn. Maybe, if she's pregnant. And maybe if it's a male. And maybe once he rises, once he becomes of a majority, right? Once he becomes of age, things will be okay for the tribe. But Eliashib, or I shouldn't just say Eliashib, the combination of the colonial powers and their deliberate misapprehension or misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the of those that they colonize, and Eliashib's own personal flaws have contributed to leave us in this tenuous, nebulous state for several years. Will the tribe survive? Who knows? Will Africa survive? Who knows? Will the colonizer finally get it right? Who knows? Think only of the unborn. The only thing we got is one little glimmer of hope here in the future.